Welcome to Share a Pint, where we tap into the craft beer scene. I'm Jerry Holla, your host.
Today we're talking with Keith Kaur from Wardaka Brewing Company. Thanks for being on the show, Keith.
Thanks for having me.
Tell us about the origin of the brewery's name and share some of the place's history with our listeners.
Sure. Origin story of Wardaka basically goes as this. Wardaka stands for Washington Recreational Day Camp. So it's the first two letters of Washington Recreational Day Camp.
Okay.
It was a farm that started in 1932 off of Old Georgetown Road inside the Beltway. It was an overnight camp from the 30s all the way to the late 80s. Kind of phased out the overnight program, the overnight camp program. We still have a day camp that runs 2 months out of the summer. And they sold that property in the late 40s, bought this property in the early 50s, and it's been here ever since. We've always had horses here. You know, as of 2015, we were an equestrian farm that does many large recognized horse events. And then in 2015, we started the brewery. You know, we're Montgomery County's first farm brewery. So now we're kind of an equestrian farm with the brewery.
Okay. Well, share with our listeners what that's like being on a site that's a full equestrian facility. What does that kind of all entail?
Sounds good. Yeah, so the whole farm is in ag preservation.
Okay.
So we're in Montgomery County's ag reserve. What that means is that we can't subdivide the property and put a bunch of houses on the property, so we've kind of put it in preservation there. What that also means is the only businesses that can be added to the farm have to be agriculturally related.
Mm-hmm.
The farm brewery, which I think Milkhouse Brewery was one of the first breweries.
They were the first Class B in Maryland. We talked to them a few episodes ago, and yeah.
Cool. They worked with us a ton to help us get open. You know, we were kind of leading Montgomery County through the process.
Right.
You know, it was Montgomery County's first time zoning, you know, working with a permanent farm brewery. So again, that kind of just fit with the current Wardaka operation. You know, this was a non-used building. So we kind of were add some value to this building. You know, it was already kind of standing here. You know, that we do have some limitations as far as, you know, we can't expand the prop. You know, everybody comes to the farm and says, you guys could make a production facility. You got tons of space. Let's build all kinds of buildings for more production and all that. You know, we can't really add to the footprint of this building.
Okay.
Because it's kind of an existing, you know, it was existing when the farm was put into preservation. So there are some limitations there.
Mm-hmm.
And then obviously the limitations that come with being a farm brewery, you know, we don't really see them as limitations. We see them as kind of mandates that we almost kind of do things the right way from an agricultural perspective.
Right.
We have a pretty large brewer's garden.
Mm-hmm.
That we grow ingredients for the beer.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we grow pumpkins, peppers. You know, one of the beer that we make the most of is our Beecher IPA, which is basically like a centennial based, almost like a two-hearted light,
like
a centennial base that features like a dry hop of lemon verbena, and that really lets the hop shine.
Mm-hmm.
And it also kind of is something that the farm can grow in volume. You know, lemon verbena and all the herbs that we grow, you know, we can have a lot of flavor production without a lot of, you know, infrastructure. You know, we can grow a couple bushes of lemon verbena, and that's quite a lot of flavor in that product. We also have about 200 Cascade hop plants on the other side of the brewery that we use kind of in one or two beers a lot of, and then we kind of sprinkle in throughout the rest of the beers. And then whatever we can't grow on site, we try to use other growers that are in the ag reserve.
Mm-hmm.
So we use Butler's a lot. You know, Sharps, while they're in Howard County, they're very close to us. Sharps Pick Your Own. You know, we feature malt that's grown and malted in Maryland. It's
mm-hmm.
not grown in the ag reserve, unfortunately, but from Chesapeake Malting Company. So, you know, we feel like we're using things that are grown on the farm, or we're using others that are doing that as like their kind of core business.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of how we, you know, again, we don't see them as limitations. We see them as kind of opportunities to use our agricultural resources. There's a ton of ag going on in Maryland, so we're happy to support them.
Yeah, and it definitely shows that you're, you know, supporting local, and it shows people that you can make great local beer with local ingredients.
Yeah.
So I think that's great. I think you mentioned that you have 12 beehives, large beehives.
I forgot the beehives. Yeah, so one of our year-round beers is our Little Dam Honey Wheat.
Mm-hmm.
Little Dam, we have a couple large lakes, and there's a Little Dam and a Big Dam.
So
okay. The Little Dam is the one that's small. Yeah, and then we have 12 really large beehives. We got 120 pounds of honey from them last year.
Okay.
All that honey goes toward Little Dam, and then we have started to use that honey in some of our double IPAs, some of our, like, our Belgian triple,
mm-hmm.
you know, things that we need the honey to kind of boost the ABV.
Right.
And that's been great. We our beekeeper, Vic, has been with us for a really long time, and he really, you know, bees are finicky, and he knows exactly what he's doing. And we now even offer some of that honey to kind of go with the cheese plates that we do. You know,
mm-hmm.
you kind of get a goat cheese and honey on a cracker, and it's been a nice, I mean, it's beautiful to have honey on the farm. And,
yeah.
Yeah, no, so I'm trying to think if there's anything else I'm missing local-wise. Yeah, the honey, the hops, herbs, brewer's garden, that's kind of what we're doing. Yeah.
Okay, well, with the honey, any thoughts of potentially adding mead to your lineup at all in the future?
Man, I would love to do mead. You know, from a regulation standpoint,
mm-hmm.
I don't know. You know, I think mead is technically counted as wine if it's over 7%.
Mm-hmm.
So we may have to, it may be a permitting, we may have to get a different license for that.
Mm-hmm.
And same thing with cider. I'm not sure that we have either of those licenses to do those products.
Mm-hmm.
If we were to make 10, we're on a 10 barrel system, so we make 300 gallons at a time.
Okay.
If we were to make, we would need a lot of honey.
Yeah.
So I don't know if my beekeeper is quite up to, to the task of that. But it's been great to, you know, he's meeting the supply for our Little Dam honey wheat,
mm-hmm.
and then we kind of have an excess to sell some here and use in some other beers. It's been great.
Okay, that's fantastic. Well, I first learned about Weird Echo at the Maryland Craft Beer Festival last November, and I enjoyed the Grumpkin.
Yeah.
So that was being poured at the time out of the back of a restored 1938 Ford pickup truck that was called the Maryland Beer Truck.
Yep.
So tell us what role that plays in the identity of your brewery.
Sure. So the Maryland Beer Truck came, you know, we opened in December of 2015, and I think we rolled out the Maryland Beer Truck maybe in the spring or summer of 2016, kind of that first real heavy season. It's owned by one of our co-owners, Brett Snyder. You know, it's built by a guy, one of our regulars, Craig King, right around the corner.
Mm-hmm.
He kind of built that, and it's got 3 half barrel kegs in the bed of the truck. The 4th half barrel is the gas tank. It's painted like fire engine red.
Mm-hmm.
It's got tons of power. Sounds amazing. It's been a great talking piece at beer festivals, at different events. We rent that out and go to weddings and things like that, and it's been a great showpiece.
Mm-hmm.
It does work, you know. It has 2 taps that come right off the tailgate.
Uh-huh.
It's got a jockey box, so it basically goes from the keg to the, and it gets cooled right there in the jockey box and comes right out of the back of the taps. And it's you know, it's just a fun way to, you know, where we are in craft beer right now, like anything that's kind of spice it up, and that's an amazing showpiece for us. And maybe Maryland Beer Truck on Facebook, but it is available for events and things like that. And so like for people that either dig really old cars or just unique beer things, it's a great option.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And it did exactly that. It caught a lot of people's eyes at Craft Beer Festival. And so everybody's got their little booths and whatnot. But you know, you go by, there a couple of guys pouring beer out of the back of a beautiful truck like that, and you're like, man, go there.
What we haven't done yet, and what will be the ultimate, is to roll into the beer festival, say, 30 minutes after it opens.
Yeah.
With all the beer in the lines, all the booths kind of set up.
Uh-huh.
Roll in, park, and pour. You know,
right.
Because it sounds amazing when that thing is moving. So
yeah.
We'll get there. That would be that's the only way to up our game with that.
Governor Larry Hogan has declared 2020 the year of the woman in Maryland,
mm.
Due to it being the 100th anniversary of the ratification of the 19th Amendment, which gave women the right to vote.
Yep.
I understand that your company is half owned by women.
Yep.
So explain why that's important in the craft beer industry.
Yeah, you know, I think that increasing diversity among our consumers is not something that we can force upon anybody, but I think that if we lead having ownership, we have our tasting room manager, Jordan, she's been a great addition to the team. You know, I think we as the staff, you know, people who work behind the bar, I think we have a really nice, diverse group of people back there.
Mm-hmm.
And whether or not that leads to a more diverse clientele or not, I don't really know how to control that. All we can do is, you know, put the right foot forward from our company. However, ever since we opened, you know, and whether this is because of the ownership or not, ever since we've opened, we have a very, we have more women that drink here than men. Our analytics show us that, you know, and then you come on a Saturday, Sunday in the fall, and it's, you know, it's a very diverse crowd here. And again, it's hard to know which happens first, but we feel as though, you know, there's a large group of consumers that may or may not feel included, and by having that diverse ownership and that diverse people behind the bar, they at least get the sense from our brewery that everyone is included here.
Absolutely. And I now wonder a little bit, too, if the tie-in with the equestrian has that, too, and I tend to think there's probably a lot more women that are involved in that side of running that, you know, business. And you know, people drawn to that and saying, hey, we're going to come out, you know, to the farm, we're going to watch some horses, and it's beautiful out here.
Yep. Yeah, it's true. You know, I can't really, my wife is an equestrian. She runs the horse side of the business. And, you know, I think that we just have a very unique, we are not in a warehouse. You know, I think that maybe just draws on a wider range of people that want to come out and drink great beer. You know, we have a large, you know, I try to keep plenty of beer, plenty of varieties of beer on tap. So we try to hit as many drinkers as we can with that. You know, we are not, I like to see different people when I go out to breweries. I don't want to see a bunch of people that look like me. And even though craft beer is kind of still much like the bearded, heavy-set white guy, we want to try to change that. And again, from our staffing and from our ownership, we can, and I'm going to try to make as many types of beers as possible to hit as many drinkers as possible.
And I think that's great. I mean, we've touched on a few other breweries when we talk with Ben at Denison's and introduced to Julie and what they're doing down there. They're pretty outspoken about being, you know, minority and female owned. Just a few places like that. And then Sarah over at Milk House is now the president of the Maryland Brewers Association,
right,
and
right,
taking a big role in that.
Yep.
Being originally an Austin girl out of Texas, she's came from a great craft beer scene. So it's really nice to see a lot of the women in Maryland really involved with, you know, brewing. And
well, it's important to me. It helps for me too. So Jessica Snyder is the other co-owner that is kind of helps with the operation of the brewery. Me and Jessica kind of run the brewery. And, you know, there are things, I'll talk to her, I'll bounce ideas off of her, and it's very valuable to hear her input because I have a hard time, she'll come up with things that I would have never even thought of. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think that's healthy to have. If I had another bearded 30 or 40 year old white guy back there with me, you know, we might not come up with the things that we've come up with so far. So, and it's hard to speak about tangible items that
right.
we've come up with, but I think just the vibe of the brewery and the types of beers and the ambiance that we create, you know, and especially with this addition of Jordan, you know, I think that's really raised us up a level. And again, it's hard to put a price on it or put tangible items to it, but I think we've done a great job with that.
Maybe talk a little bit about what Jordan added to what you had already done. You talked a lot about what Jessica brought, and that sounds like a really good balance the way you laid it out. And then you added Jordan. So what did she add? What did you notice within, you know, the short time that you'd hired her?
So Jordan brings all kinds of different skills to the brewery. She's from the service industry, so she has her eyes on the quality of service that we're providing. She's very good. She's very outgoing, outspoken to clientele, and can just the ability for her to manage people and hit all different kinds of people that come into our tasting room and work for us has really been a great addition. You know, it was also helpful. She was not very experienced with the beer side of things, and that we deal with a lot of new customers that are new to craft. Her not really having a lot of craft experience under your belt was almost a good thing, because that's a lot of the clientele that we have coming in here. You know, I wouldn't say that we're the biggest. I think that people now are starting to become more educated in this area about craft. But when we first opened, we were doing a lot of education. And with Jordan, she kind of sees it from a fresh lens of, what if I'm not the beer drinker? Why should I come to Wardaka? And she's done a great job kind of promoting us there.
Well, that's great. That's great. You mentioned being seasonal. So explain how you balance the less busy times of the year, like now during the winter months.
Yeah. So yes, we are, we're located on a 230-acre horse farm. We have nearly unlimited outside space. In the spring, summer, and fall, our limitation is really how many people can we park? Mm-hmm. How many bathrooms do we have?
Yeah.
In the winter, you know, it gets dark earlier. Today it's like a super blustery, it's sunny out, but it looks nice out, but it's not so nice out. It's a harder ask to get people, you know, I think there's a reason that people drink wine and spirits and watch a lot of television in the winter. You know, mm-hmm. people kind of huddle in mm-hmm. and, you know, kind of do their own thing. That does play a little bit of havoc on our business. You know, I think it's good for everybody to kind of exhale, mm-hmm. but at the same time, you know, we need to get the brew house moving and things like that. So the way we have dealt with that thus far, we focus a lot on distribution.
Mm-hmm.
So we are draft only, but we try to do, you know, different tap takeovers, beer dinners, you know, make sure all of our accounts are getting FaceTime. Mm-hmm. You know, while we are slow, bars and restaurants do pretty well in the winter because, again, people are, you know, I think people kind of go, they don't go to the outside venues. You know, we're much more of an outside venue. So we try to make sure all of our accounts are taken care of. And then we are launching our own food service in conjunction with Pizza Brahma is the company that does some pizza here. Mm-hmm. It's opening a new food service here. So we're going to have kind of offer our own food service so people can come here at night on a Friday night and make it a one stop. They don't have to come here, drink some beer, and then go get real food. They right. can kind of come here and do it all here.
Okay.
And so that's kind of one of the ways we're trying to, you know, kind of combat that. We got a really nice warm space in here,
mm-hmm.
But people only sometimes, you know, we get tons of questions still, like, when do you close down for the winter? It's like, we're open the same hours.
Right.
Like, so I think just trying to provide that kind of one-stop shop, you know, with full food availability, and then kind of focusing on distro and making sure the beers are, you know, kind of rotating and fresh and making sure all our accounts get the right service.
Okay. And then I think you mentioned that you're starting canning in March.
Yeah, we are canning.
That sounds exciting. Tell us about that.
Yeah, so again, we're just over 4 years old now. We're probably the oldest brewery to make, you know, we make around 900 barrels of beer. We're probably the oldest one of those breweries to not ever have packaged product. So we are finally going to get over that. And if anybody out there has anybody to blame, they can blame me. I was kind of dragging my heels a little bit to make sure that the demand was high enough.
Right.
And I think it is now.
Mm-hmm.
The demand for cans is there. I think our accounts are going to get really excited if we're going to try to sell as much on site as possible. So
yeah.
The accounts may or may not. I don't know how much they're going to get. But yeah, we're gonna can some 16-ounce cans. Ironheart's going to come in and do mobile canning. We'll be doing that at the end of March, our
mm-hmm.
first run. And we're really excited about it. You know, I'm excited to take my beer to the beach.
Mm-hmm.
I've never shotgunned my own beer, so I'm excited to do that. And, you know, there's a lot of upsides. I was a little worried about, you know, again, we try to keep in touch with what the fads are and what the current trends are, but we try to make sure it's right for us.
Yeah.
And it's right for us now. You know,
I think we're
all on board and excited. We got some more capacity coming in just in case it is a good hit. So yeah,
absolutely.
We're excited.
And there's a lot to do outside in this country. There's beautiful places to hike and
yep.
bike, and there's places to be outside. And so I think that's great to be able to pack in, pack out.
Yep.
You know, throw
yep.
some six pack cans in a cooler and here you go.
Yeah. We're going to do, like I said, we're going to do a smaller run. You know,
mm-hmm.
we're going to try to make sure that the product stays fresh. You know, one of my biggest worries was everybody now has cans in the market.
Right.
And, you know, I think that we're probably not going to be able to generate the pull from a liquor store to tell them you only get this beer if it goes in the fridge.
Right.
We're gonna try that.
Yeah.
But you know, my worry was that with so much packaged product on the shelf, I don't want someone's first Beecher IPA to be something that sat on the shelf for 5 weeks. So because of that, we're probably going to can some smaller volumes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, which will make it. That we'll turn the product over so that, you know, there'll probably be gaps. You know, we're going to stagger these canning runs. It might be something that runs out in a couple weekends, and that's a good thing. But I know from the consumer side, you know, it creates problems. You know, some people want to wait in line, but others don't. You know, I don't think we're not going to try to be the line the line can release thing. I think those that day has come and gone. I don't really want the farm to be filled up with a bunch of people drinking in line.
Yeah.
At the same time, I think we are going to can volumes that are small enough that we feel like the product will turn quick enough so that every can that's purchased is at least fresh when it was purchased.
Right. Now, I think that's a smart approach. And then, like you said, that you create that demand by people going, man, that was really good. What do you mean I can't get that?
Yeah, and I think people
maybe they come here because of that, or maybe they just, you know, tell their local place of where it was, restaurant, liquor store, whatever, say, hey, you know, you guys got to get more of that.
Yeah.
That's great.
Yeah, and you know, we're learning. This is new to us. You know, the reason we didn't, you know, I kind of wanted to be able to, you know, lay out the cash for our own canning line. At the same time, I understand that's quite a, you know, we're kind of, it's a big financial commitment, you know. What we're doing with Ironheart is definitely financially, you know, it's cost prohibitive, but at the same time, there's a lot less cash layout. You know, you're laying out cash just for this small amount of cans, whereas
right.
like a $50,000 canning line, then you gotta really make it work. So there's a lot of ups and downs, but we're really excited. You know, I think that there's definitely been tons of accounts that have been asking for it. So again, we have to kind of balance how much we sell over the bar, how much we sell elsewhere, and how much we sell to accounts. But yeah, we're excited.
Well, I think a lot of listeners aren't really, you know, they're not really informed enough to know how big of a choice that is, how much of a financial investment, you know, really. When we talked with Jake at Smoketown, they had recently started that, and that was one of the things he talked about when they had somebody else doing the canning for them. He said, people don't understand how much that cuts into your bottom line and how cost prohibitive it can be.
Yep.
So they were excited to finally have that and get that started and take that next step for that same reason, because then it becomes, you know, a little bit better of a profit margin for you guys. And I don't think the average consumer realizes that when they're thinking about getting their beer.
Yeah, a few things on that. You know, the reason we're going to try to sell as much over the bar as we can is that's the best margin for us, you know. Also keep in mind that when you spend $15 a four-pack at your own liquor store, the percentage of that money that's going to that liquor store and that's going back to the brewery is high. You know what I mean? So the reason they are expensive is because the breweries that you are buying from them from are small. All that to be said, the product has to be legit. You know what I mean? I'm not really, you know, I'm past the point of local just means good,
right.
You know, so that's definitely something that we want to keep in mind as far as freshness. You know, we're trying to make sure that we can small volumes so that if you see it, you know that it's been canned in the last 3 or 4 weeks. You know, a lot of beer that comes from distributors that may have sat in their warehouse for three or four weeks even before it goes to the liquor store. So we're trying to really, really stay on that. All our cans will be date coded. So people will be able to know that it's fresh. You know, we're going to make sure we keep our oxygen levels low, so that the liquid going into the can is then sealed with as little O2 as possible. And again, like, beer is starting to get expensive, but as long as you're buying it from either a liquor store or buying it from a brewery that you care about, the percentage of money that goes right back into your community is a really high percentage compared to, you know, I'm drinking this craft Pilsner, which if we put this in cans, this would be, you know, I don't even know a price, but it would be more than 4 16-ounce cans of Bud Light that you can buy.
Yeah.
But the amount of money that you are helping me, and you are helping all the other owners and all the other employees, and then you're also, and that's going to go right back into the community, maybe of a business they own, or, you know, that's the rub. You know, somebody was talking to me about, why am I going to spend so much for a craft Pilsner over just this big Pilsner? And I think, to me, that's where the rub is you can really invest in your community, and the money, even though it's going to be more expensive, like, you're keeping the money in the state, you're keeping the money in the town, you might be keeping it around the block. So, and that feels good.
Absolutely. You know? And I do think that matters to people, particularly in the craft beer industry. They're looking at that more. So the fact that you do so much with local ingredients, and it really means more than just putting a tag of local in front of your beer, it really means more. I think it does. You connect with the community, and they're going to be invested in you, and it's a good approach.
Yeah. I mean, it's, you know, and I think that we're about to experience a little shakeout with craft, and beers, prices are going to, I think people will be starting to kind of, not price gouge, but, you know, beer is going to get competitive out there. And I think that as long as you can get the price that you need to charge, kind of keep the lights on, and then you back it up with quality, I think that people will hopefully continue to support.
Absolutely. So. Absolutely. Well, where can people find you guys online? Facebook, Twitter, Instagram?
So we are at wardakabrewing.com is our website. We're at wardakabrewing on Facebook. But yeah, all of our events, you know, we do live music on Fridays and Saturday nights, kind of in the spring, summer, and fall. Mm-hmm. We do live music on Saturdays, still throughout the year. In our tasting room here, kind of some lower key music. We have food trucks the whole month of February. We're going to have food on, I think it's either Friday through Sunday or maybe Thursday through Sunday. So we'll have a lot of food options, rotating pretzels. Yeah, it's going to be nice. Yeah, all that can be found on our Facebook page. Also, you know, our Facebook page is linked to our Untappd account. So if you ever want to know what beers are Untappd, Facebook does have our Untappd kind of link that mm-hmm. you can see what's currently on tap, or you can just go on to Untappd and figure out what beers are on tap. That's a great spot for us.
Well, we'll make that available in our show notes, and we'll put that on sharedpintpodcast.com for you.
Great.
Well, we've learned about the brewery. Now let's get to know you a little bit better. Mm-hmm. Keith, tell us about your role here at Weird.com.
So, you know, I'm one of the co-owners, and I'm the head brewer. It's basically me and another guy making and delivering all the beer. Which is kind of fun and unique. and I kind of help with deliveries, help with production, scheduling. You know, Jessica, my colleague, the other owner that kind of helps run the place, she does a lot of the local ingredient cultivation. Mm-hmm. So she definitely kind of spearheads that. But as far as the liquid making and maintaining everything having to do with the liquid, that's what I do.
Okay, great. Well, how did you get started in the craft beer industry?
Yeah, so Ellicott City, old town Ellicott City, Phoenix, which is going away at the end of March. I drink a lot of beer there. Okay. Me and my wife lived right across the street, so that was our local place for about a year and a half. And she lived there a lot longer before I came into the scene, but really fell in love with craft beer there. Really had some knowledgeable bartenders, and they had a ton of different selections. No draft beer, but a bunch of different cans, bottles from all over the world. Drank a bunch of beer there, really fell in love with craft. I was teaching high school at the time, and you know, there was a year in between year four and year five of teaching that I had the opportunity to go into a school in Howard County, stay in Prince William County, or stay in Fairfax County, or take a job at Flying Dog Brewery.
Oh.
I took a job at Flying Dog. And I worked there for 4 years.
Okay.
You know, I did about 6 months in the lab, kind of learning, running ABV, you know, running gravities, taking yeast out of the bottom of tanks, dry hopping tanks, kind of a little bit of the grunt work, and mm-hmm. then kind of phased into learning clean tanks and moving wort. And then learned how to filter beer and carbonate beer, and then finally learned how to brew the beer. There's kind of three different departments at Flying Dog from the production side.
Mm-hmm.
Worked there for 4 years, loved every minute of it, you know, learned a ton. Kind of was ready for the next transition, but if Wardaka hadn't came, I probably would still be at Flying Dog, you know. I felt very comfortable there and was a good fit.
Okay. Right. Well, once you made that transition, tell us maybe what some of your biggest challenges were here at Wardaka.
Yeah, I remember when this idea came up, I was excited and nervous. Mm-hmm. You know, I made a ton of liquid, thousands and thousands of gallons of liquid, but at Flying Dog, that almost was so less personal than this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're talking about making, that was a 50 barrel system and we have a 10 barrel system. And so I was nervous, you know, Flying Dog has a system that's similar to our size. They have a 15 barrel, and that had come maybe a year or two before I left Flying Dog. So that was a great experience for me to kind of see how recipes translate down,
mm-hmm.
what it's like, you know, timing wise, what it's like labor wise, how the fermentations go in tanks that size. So that was really helpful for me. I wanted to make the liquid. I didn't want people to leave here being saying, beautiful spot. Wish they had better liquid. Yeah, I was a little worried about that, and I figured that as long as I could make the liquid match the setting,
mm-hmm.
at a minimum, that I was doing okay. So that's kind of what I was a little bit nerve-wracked about. There's a ton of different sides of the business that I did not learn at Flying Dog, not the least of which was sales.
Mm-hmm.
So I would definitely tell people out there to not only, you know, if you were going to open a brewery, making the beer should be like super easy. Mm-hmm. You should be able to make beer with your eyes closed, and you should be able to make it fast and to be doing three other things at the same time, because that's kind of what you have to do. Especially before I got my assistant, Zach, I was doing everything, and we were doing a lot less liquid then, but that's tough. And at the end of my 4 years at Flying Dog, I could make beer that way. Mm-hmm. And I was kind of already doing that at Flying Dog. I was making beer, and making beer was almost a side thing, but I was kind of doing some management and some other things. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that's paramount to opening your own place, is making sure that you can make the beer taste great, but then do all the other things to run it a business. The whole business side of things, again, which Jessica does a lot of, it's just like running any other small business. We wear a ton of hats. You know, again, I do a lot less making beer than business, you know, ordering, scheduling, you know, all the things that come with any other small business.
Right. Okay. Well, then how did you stay committed during those difficult times?
Well, we had just started, so I there was no option. Yeah, there was no option. We were lucky that we got supported by the community way more than we ever thought we were going to. When we originally wrote the business plan, we thought we'd move a lot of beer to bars and restaurants, mm-hmm. and we thought we'd have this little small tasting room, and like maybe people will find us and maybe not. But we wrote it so that we'd be distroing a lot of beer. Well, that flipped immediately, where we do right now we're still around 50-50, I think, mm-hmm. of actually maybe a little bit more on-site than off-site, but at the very beginning it was a ton of beer on-site and hardly any going out. Now that our name is out there, you know, we're kind of more that's balanced out a little bit. Mm-hmm. There was no choice of how to cope, you know. You gotta do it all, and I was the only one with any kind of industry experience, mm-hmm. so I was, but again, I didn't have sales experience, so that I kind of, and still do, fall on my face when it comes to sales. Like, you know, I'm not the best, when it comes to that. And it's, you know, selling beer, selling anything, but selling beer is such a person to person thing. And I wouldn't take it personally if they wouldn't buy my beer, but I would also just like remember who didn't buy it, and I would go back to the lab and make it better, and then come back to them 2 months later and say, now you want it, right? You know, so I'm happy that we have salespeople. Well, and they're doing a great job for
you. You don't know it, you've tried to surround yourself with people who do while you're learning your way through it. So.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you kind of touched on it a little bit with your experience at Flying Dog, and then, you know, the switch and the support from the community. But maybe, you know, is there anything else that you felt like really contributed to your success?
We have a really diverse team on the ownership side. One of the reasons we got open very quickly. We were the first one in first farm brewery in Montgomery mm-hmm. County, again, but one of the reasons that we got open so quickly was, one of our owners is in the kind of architect building side of the industry. Another one of our owners has worked here for over 30 years. He's the farm manager. And so the integration between the brewery and the farm, he's really helpful at. My wife is on the equestrian side, so that kind of, again, kind of links us to the farm, so we're able to kind of, what we need from the farm, the farm can help with, and what the farm needs from us, we can, you know, there's a good relationship there. Mm-hmm. I think that was very beneficial in our launch. We've had very low staff turnover. One of the things that's been a great success has been, for whatever reason, knock on wood, and it's not because of the best management. It's because for whatever reason, they like working here. They like the community. They like to see the regulars. The regulars are a great thing for our staff, but our staff tends to stay for a while. And that's been great. And that's been, I think, one of our successes. We have very busy Saturdays and Sundays in the spring, summer, and fall. Our staff gets worked really hard. Mm-hmm. And we love that they've stayed with us. And I think that's been one of our big successes as well.
Yeah, I think consistency sometimes a little underrated. Sarah and Tom both mentioned that at Milk House about how long all the people that had been working there stayed and how much that made an impact.
Yeah.
All the things that you mentioned, your connection to the community, your connection with your customers, just a comfortable feel, and then, you know, people knowing where to jump in and fill in roles because of so many hats being worn. They're like, oh, I see that that needs to get done. I'll just go take care of it.
Yep. And yeah, like I said, like, we are not the world's best managers. You know, we're trying to, we treat our employees great, but I think it's just this place. You know, Wardaka, with being an overnight camp from the, you know, from the 30s to the late 80s, basically every weekend we have people that come back and say, I was here in the 60s and now my kids are riding horses, they're drinking beer. Those people, I think, kind of, that our staff kind of feeds off that community vibe. You know, I hope that our staff, even if they, you know, move on to other things, I hope they always feel welcome to come back and drink a beer and kind of, just have it be a part of their lives, and we really hope that all the kids that come here, I hope they come back when they're 21 too, because we have a lot of kids of non-drinking age, so hope they come back and drink a beer.
Absolutely. And then it means you've been around long enough if you can last that long.
Yeah, right? We'll be here.
That's awesome. Well, again, where can people find you online with your Facebook and,
Wardakabrewing.com. Facebook is Wardaka Brewing Company. We just went over 10,000 followers. We would love to get your follow. We have a great, social media content. We think we have really, really nice content. And then we are a verified Untappd venue, so you can always go to untappd.com and find Wardaka Brewing Company as a verified venue, and you can look for, you know, all the beers on tap. And then, again, Facebook and our website have live music and food trucks and kind of whatever is special coming up, and we'll soon have can releases, I'm sure.
Yeah, it'll be awesome. Yeah, well, that's great. Like I said, we'll put that up at sharepintpodcast.com so
great.
You can share that with listeners. Well, Keith, I want to thank you for your time and for sharing a pint with me.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Share a Pint is released bi-weekly on Friday mornings and can be found at sharepintpodcast.com. Follow us on Twitter at share_pint. Show notes for this episode are available at sharepintpodcast.com. Music for the show, Groundwork, provided by Kevin MacLeod, and can be found online at incompetech.com. Share a Pint is made possible by help from the Community Media Center of Carroll County. Associated with the craft beer industry and have an interesting story you'd like to share on a future episode? Let us know. We'd love to hear from you. You can reach us at sharepintpodcast.com or email us at jerry@sharepintpodcast.com. Until the next time we share a pint, I'm Jerry Hulla. Prost.